You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Ricker. Coming up, mosquito-borne diseases like Zika are making the insects public enemy number one this summer. We'll find out how scientists are working to manage mosquitoes.
First, businesses around the state currently have the ability to ban guns on their premises. This was part of Wisconsin's concealed carry law, which passed in 2011. But a new bill being proposed in the assembly could add a new wrinkle.
It's called the Disarmed Citizen Compensation Act, and it would make these businesses liable for injuries that happen in their establishment. Under the law, if it ultimately passes, people could sue the business three times over if they were unable to protect themselves with a firearm.
Joining us now to talk about his new bill is Republican Representative Bob Gannon from Slinger. He represents the 58th Assembly District. Representative Gannon, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you for having me.
Well, can you talk first through the basics? What would change under the legislation that you're working on?
Well, actually, I believe this takes the concealed carry weapon law in the state of Wisconsin and makes it go full circle. Currently, the law adds some tort protection, some protection against liability for business owners that allow concealed carry holders on their premise. If they allow a concealed carry holder on their premise and that person uses the weapon and hurts somebody, the business cannot be held liable. Conversely, we have nothing that says that a business is liable if they don't allow a citizen of this state to protect themselves, and that's where this law is going. It's closing the gap. Now, if a business with this law passed, if a business does not allow you to carry on their premise, it will become their responsibility for your safety. The law would make it a strict liability, which means you do not need to litigate whose fault it is. All you have to do is prove they had to sign up and did not allow you to conceal carry. And then that you go right to the damages phase. And based on this original proposal, it would be three times damages, which is it's designed purposely to encourage businesses to allow citizens to join the security of our country.
Right. So that's the main idea here. Not so much that this law would come into effect that much and the triple liability, but it would be an incentive, I guess, for businesses to not post a gun-free zone sign.
Yeah, the term used in law enforcement is force multiplier, and we do live in a different world. I hate to break the news to anybody that's been living under a rock, but we're not living in Mayberry anymore, and there are people that are bound and determined to harm others, and we better be prepared for it. I hope never in my lifetime that anybody has to pay triple damages. I hope that my lifetime there's not another terrorist attack. That's not realistic, though.
And this came out, though I understand you've been working on it, this came out after the shootings, of course, in Orlando. Was that part of what led you to bring this out now?
Yeah, the reason I released it now, even though we're not in session until January, is I do believe that what came out of Orlando is they kept blaming the gun instead of actually talking about the fact that we have terrorists and we have common criminals, local criminals, homegrown, that are bound and determined to harm people. So taking rights, Second Amendment rights away from law-abiding citizens just did not seem to me like the correct answer to the terrorist issue.
Have you heard a lot of support from constituents or from fellow lawmakers so far?
Well, actually, honestly, I've heard some pushback from some lawmakers in my own party that they don't like more tort law and more liability. So this may be tweaked and be changed a little bit before it gets put out. I have heard strongly, and when I do the research, some of them are actually kind of abusive, and they seem to be coming from more liberal bastions of the state. They're not coming from my district. So in my district, actually, there's very few businesses that have a no weapons policy. There's only certain pockets of this state that have this. But unfortunately, they are in the urban areas, which have been the center of terrorist activity.
A lot of people will point toward the numbers when it comes to gun deaths and say, yes, these mass shootings are horrible, but they're rare. A lot more gun deaths happen in things like suicides, of course, but also domestic violence, disputes on the street, in a bar, things like that. They're worried that having more guns in public places, especially public places with alcohol involved, might create more risk for people. What do you say to that?
Yeah, it's a debate that should be had. But the reality is we've had very, very few issues with the concealed carry weapon law in Wisconsin by the law-abiding citizen. The person that is violating the CCW law is the same person that would be a criminal without the law. people that respect law and order are not violating the law. It's people that do not have respect. My law change, my statute changes to defend those that actually follow the law. There's nothing we can do with those that are going to violate any law regardless.
We're talking to State Representative Bob Gannon about his proposed legislation. It'll actually be formally unveiled in January in a new session on gun laws, concealed carry and no carry zones, gun-free zones, and liability for that. I understand you come from the insurance industry yourself. Did that inform how you approach this law?
Well, it actually gives me a knowledge of how the tort system works, how civil justice works. And you know, it's kind of a little bit interesting in that trial attorneys have told me over and over again in my 34 years in the insurance business that part of the reason they sue businesses for product liability because their product injured somebody or for premises slip and falls is to try to create a safer place for all consumers. Well, I think the trial attorney should jump all over this one because we're trying to create a safer place for all consumers, and we're going to hold businesses liability just as they do if a little bit of water sprayed on the grocery floor and somebody slipped, or just like they would do if somebody was negligent with a car. We're going to hold businesses responsible for having a safe place of business.
People who are maybe not concealed carry license holders themselves, people who are not people who own or carry guns in public, worry about the other end. A headline in Milwaukee just the other day, a gun accidentally discharged a shrapnel, mildly injuring four people. But people worry about that. Does this person have a gun, first of all? Are they handling it safely? Do I have to be watching out for guns every time I go out to, I don't know, a restaurant or a movie?
Well, actually, this does not preclude a business from still being a gun-free zone. Mm-hmm. They can put up the sign and be a weapon-free zone. That's not stopped by this law. All it means, though, is they will be responsible if they do not have a defense mechanism for keeping their guests safe. I would recommend metal detectors. I would recommend security guards. I would recommend knowing your customers. There's a lot of ways to protect your consumer and put them in a safe place. This actually should make those that are uncomfortable around guns very, very happy, because this will mean that when a business truly puts up a no concealed carry sign, that they are going to keep you safe. They're not just putting up a sign and saying, well, the sign made you safe. Because signs, if you aren't aware, the Azana Salon Spa shooting, the Sikh Temple shooting, the school shooting, the shopping center with the congresswoman,
Gifford.
At a food store. We've had them in movie theaters. Now we had them at a nightclub. Those were all gun-free zones. And I'm sure your listeners felt very safe because they don't like guns, but unfortunately, the common thug and criminal didn't follow that little paper sign.
People have pointed to the Orlando shooting, saying, you know, the bouncer, at least one bouncer was armed. I think off-duty or former police officer, there was a firefight that didn't enhance safety, they argue.
Yes, it's because if I was a criminal and he had cased that joint many, many times, there's very clear documentation that this shooter was very wise and went in and knew where that guy was. And he went in and took out the only defense in the property. Now, if there was a citizen like me that doesn't drink alcohol but still goes to dance clubs, there's a chance that I may have been carrying and he wouldn't know where I am in the premise or who I am. It would have been much, much safer. Instead of 49 dead, maybe we'd only have 48. I think that's worth the risk.
The Journal Sentinel talked to some people in the business community, not excited about this, I think partly just because of the risk of liability, the idea of state-imposed mandates that they're not comfortable with. How would you sell this to business owners?
Well, and that's where it may be tweaked before it gets introduced, because I am not a fan of big government telling people how to do it. I think what we do is we make this as make it as workable as possible so that the businesses can make their places safe and make the consumers safe. The state legislature does this daily. Your food safety is predicated based on state statutes on how they must handle your food. It's everywhere you go, the state legislature has stuck their nose in to tell businesses how to run it to keep the consumer safe. The smoking law, making every business in the state of Wisconsin non-smoking, was sold to the citizens and to the legislature that we're going to keep the consumers safe. We're going to keep the employees safe. Well, this is the exact same thing. So I do understand that conservatives like myself don't like more regulations, but sometimes we have to do it to counter the other side of the aisle.
And before we let you go, are you familiar with similar laws in other states, or would this be, as far as you know, a first here in Wisconsin?
Yeah, to the best of my knowledge, it's been a first. It has gone nationwide. It's in the national press, and I have seen no documentation that anybody else has come up with it. We are doing a search at this time that I've heard that there's some other, in the same vein of thought, some other legislation that's been proposed or passed in other states, and we are doing research there. Because, as I say, until this gets released in January, it's open for consideration on how to truly word it. Part of the beauty of the deliberative process, the neat part of a democracy, is we have a significant conversation before we pass the laws. What I come up with has to get 49 other state representatives to agree to. So I've got more work to do.
Representative Gannon, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Yeah, thanks for having me on.
Bob Gannon is the Republican representative from Wisconsin's 58th Assembly District. He joined us to talk about his new Disarmed Citizen Compensation Act, which he'll be introducing in the next session of the Assembly. The bill would hold gun-free businesses liable for gun-related injuries.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, we'll break down the decisions announced by the U.S. Supreme Court yesterday, including one on gun ownership for those convicted of domestic abuse.
First, as mosquito-borne diseases like Zika and dengue fever continue to spread, mosquitoes are proving to be more than a nuisance. They're a serious public health concern.
To tackle the problem, researchers are exploring a new range of high-tech solutions to the mosquito problem, including genetically engineered extinction and increased immunity to viruses.
Alessio Bayak joins us now. He's a senior writer for Undark magazine in Cambridge, Massachusetts. Alessio, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks so much for the invitation.
Well, it sounds like one trend in combating mosquito-borne diseases is using gene drives to change the outcome in wild mosquito populations. And can you explain what the term gene drives means?
So gene drives really cool. I mean, it's the idea basically of cheating evolution. And so you might remember from Biology 101 that, you know, a child gets half their genomes from each parent, right? And so then that comes together and creates the offspring. And so you could imagine overriding those rules, right? And so that's what gene drive does, is by essentially giving the genetic code more than a 50% chance of being inherited, right? And so then across an entire wild population, depending on how quick the generations are, so, you know, bugs have really short generations, elephants and humans have long generations, you could technically start replacing a gene pretty quickly within a population, up to almost 100%. So you could push a gene, or drive in this case, all the way through an entire wild population.
And so one idea on the table here is to use that technology you're describing to make mosquitoes sterile. How would that work?
So that's a pretty interesting proposal here, where you could take a mosquito that, say, transmits yellow fever or Zika or dengue, and introduce some kind of sterile gene, some kind of gene or a set of genes that would render it sterile. And so one way they've described this is driving maleness through a population, so that every offspring that is created out in the wild ends up being male. And so after a while, there's no females floating around or flying around, and that entire population would crash. So that's one of the ideas behind engineering sterility, right, into mosquitoes.
Well, so just to take that example, if you've gotten rid of all the mosquitoes, I suppose scientists and biologists have to say, well, what happens to the species that feed on mosquitoes and other things like that that we may not be thinking about? Who's asking those questions?
Well, that's interesting, because a lot of actually, academies of science, the National Academies of Science, for example, large groups of researchers, even kind of international organizations are raising those alarms and kind of asking scientists to rein this in a little bit and say, let's think about the actual ecosystemic effects of what it means to remove, say, one species or all mosquitoes. And there are some interesting writing and essays out there. Just Google around for driving extinction of mosquitoes, and you see a lot of that. The alarm bells, the idea of, hey, we need to, before we enact some kind of sweeping proposal like this, think about what the effects are going to be on the rest of the environment.
So another one of these genetically driven possibilities, you talk to a researcher who's looking to possibly boost immunity in mosquitoes so that they wouldn't pick up these viruses, for example, like the Zika virus. So what do we know about the shape of that idea so far?
That was a cool idea and definitely kind of less developed in terms of field trials than a lot of the other research we've seen in terms of genetically modified mosquitoes being released in kind of early trials. But the idea is, could we essentially vaccinate a mosquito? I mean, it's not explicitly that, but the idea is, could we boost the immune systems of these mosquitoes that tend to carry Zika or dengue or chikungunya or one of these viruses? Could we help them resist those viruses and, in a sense, create a superbug that would be resistant to picking up the Zika virus? Because if a mosquito can't be infected by the Zika virus, then there's no way it's going to bite and pass that along. Mosquito needs to be infected first before it can transmit that virus to a human.
And again, as you discovered talking to this researcher, there are some questions there too. I mean, what if you've got, as you said, the superbug who has the super immune system? Does that mean it lives four times as long as the average mosquito? And what does that mean for mosquito populations?
Precisely. And there is a kind of early research, at least in the lab, about this. And they found sometimes the opposite, where, you know, you might introduce a gene that would boost its immune system, but the mosquito actually won't live as long as its wild cousins. And you could imagine if you release those into the wild and spend a lot of money on that trial, and then they just don't fare well in the wild compared with their kind of wild cousins, that's a lot of money wasted, right? So those are the kind of experiments we need to be doing.
We're talking with Alessio Bajek right now. He wrote about the science of mosquito management in the face of things like mosquito-borne illnesses like Zika and dengue fever. Wrote about that for Undark magazine in Cambridge, Massachusetts. And it sounds as though there have been already some genetically modified mosquitoes released in some parts of the world. What do we know about how those initial efforts are going?
Well, so those are pretty interesting. I mean, I think what we might be conflating with genetic modification is the introduction of, let's say, a bacteria. So infect a mosquito egg with a bacteria that will be harmful to the mosquito. And so that's something that's kind of the furthest along right now, and that bacteria is called Wolbachia. And that what it does is kind of make it resistant to viruses, also shorten the lifespan of mosquitoes. So that's one thing that's being released is mosquitoes, all male mosquitoes that are released into the wild with this bacteria inside them, in places like Fresno, California, right outside Fresno. And, you know, the idea is that the eggs that are fertilized by these mosquitoes won't hatch because they have this kind of detrimental bacteria in them. But where genetically modified mosquitoes are being used, and something that with the Zika epidemic has gotten a lot more attention, is what a British company called Oxitec is doing. And though initially they started working with sterility, so the idea of kind of making a male mosquito that you could release into the wild, and then upon mating, it would render the offspring sterile or kill them. But now what they're doing is something interesting where you rear these in the laboratory and you make these mosquitoes dependent on some kind of chemical, in this case, an antibiotic. So if you don't supply the antibiotic, and obviously if you release them into the wild, they won't have the antibiotic because you have it in the lab, they're all going to die. So that they then pass on that need for the antibiotic into subsequent generations, right, their offspring, and then they would die in the wild. So that's another idea that's being pioneered by this Oxitec company.
Alessio, what do we know about the implications of the kind of research that we've been talking about so far and other pests that carry diseases, ticks, things like Lyme's disease, things like invasive species?
So that's what's really interesting about the idea of a gene drive, of somehow being able to push with the latest kind of genetic engineering tools, a gene into a wild population, because it might not necessarily be for a disease-causing organism like a mosquito, but you might be able to eliminate an invasive species. So they're talking about doing this with lionfish, which are those kind of spiny, poisonous fish floating around the Caribbean now, which have become so much of a nuisance that even trying to sell these and create recipes for these haven't dropped the numbers in the Caribbean, at least. Also, with Lyme disease, it's pretty interesting. There's a proposal to kind of engineer a mouse that would be resistant to Lyme disease, because obviously that's kind of upstream of when the tick infects a deer or the tick infects a human. Generally, they're kind of hanging out with these mice. And so one idea would be, hey, could we use that same mechanism that we're talking about with mosquitoes to give a mouse population a gene that make them resistant to Lyme disease, right? So if you cut it off at the foot, right, maybe we'd have, fewer cases of Lyme in humans.
So it seems like everything we've talked about today has pretty big questions that still need to be answered, namely about how the ripple effect would affect the rest of the biological community, the ecosystem around it. But assuming that some of those questions are put to bed, how far away are we from some of these ideas reaching fruition and being put into action?
Well, the idea of the Oxitec, the sterile mosquitoes and these antibiotic-dependent mosquitoes, those have already been released in places like Brazil. They're in early stages of trials, but the bacteria-infused mosquitoes, for example, have already been released. So there's definitely a need for more people to kind of read about this and know about this and talk to their mosquito abatement districts, right, the control boards, and ask them what they're doing. Because it's interesting to look at where the latest science is on this. But of course, a lot of the gene drive stuff is years away. The mouse experiment with Lyme, for example, at least 10 years, they say.
Alessio, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you so much for the invitation. Take care.
Alessio Vajac is a senior writer for Undark magazine, where he wrote about mosquitoes and mosquito management there. That magazine is published in Cambridge, Massachusetts.
Coming up, we'll get another perspective on the U.S. Supreme Court's ruling on the Texas abortion law. Then we'll talk to an analyst about all the court's big decisions released yesterday. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. You're listening to Central Time.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. Coming up at 7, it's Latino USA. This week, they talk about what makes a sanctuary for LGBT people of color, from the safety and freedom of gay clubs to Latino USA listeners sharing stories about LGBT gyms and choral groups. That's tonight at 7 o'clock on Latino USA.
First, a look at the three U.S. Supreme Court decisions announced yesterday. The High Court overturned a Texas law that required abortion providers to have admitting privileges at a hospital within 30 miles. Justices also upheld restrictions that prevent individuals convicted of misdemeanor counts of domestic violence from owning a gun. And in another ruling, the Supreme Court made it harder to prosecute public officials for corruption, overturning the conviction of Bob McDonnell, former governor of Virginia. We'll talk to Barbara Perry from the University of Virginia about those decisions in just a few minutes.
But first, Julaine Appling is with us. Yesterday, we spoke to a guest from the National Women's Law Center about the Supreme Court's ruling on the Texas abortion law. And now we're getting another perspective on that case. Julaine Appling is president of Wisconsin's Family Action. Julaine, welcome back to Central Time.
Hi, Veronica. Thank you for the opportunity.
So, Julaine, what was your first reaction when you heard the news yesterday of that Supreme Court decision on the Texas abortion law?
Well, to be honest with you, with this court right now, I'm not surprised any longer with these kinds of rulings, but of course I am disappointed. I continue to be pretty much an eternal optimist, and I hope that the court will understand that states have the right to determine laws for the well-being of women and to make appropriate laws related to abortion. And I believe the court got this one very wrong.
And, of course, today the court rejected appeals from Wisconsin and from Mississippi over laws that would require abortion providers to have admitting privileges at a nearby hospital. That appeal rejected today. Did that news surprise you?
No, that doesn't surprise me, because the major part of the Texas case, and I'm pretty sure Wisconsin also filed an amicus brief on that Texas case, by the way, Veronica. Mm-hmm. But a part of that was the being requiring that doctors who do abortions have admitting privileges to hospitals within a 30-mile radius of where the abortions are being performed. And so when they struck down that law for Texas, I couldn't see a path for them to be willing to take the case that Attorney General Schimmel was involved with here in Wisconsin. So I'm not surprised. Look, we passed those laws 2 or 3 years ago in Wisconsin. Our organization worked hard to do it because we believe that we need to give women the very best opportunity to protect their safety and their well-being. Abortion is not a procedure that is without risk. And I don't have a report in front of me because I'm on the road right now, but I know that there are thousands of women who have abortions who have complications. And of those, there is a 10% of those that end up in the needing hospitalization. Look, you know, we want to make sure that a woman who's in that situation in Wisconsin, her doctor, her abortionist can get her into a hospital and get her admitted to get the proper care. I tell you, this is just yet another example of the federal government encroaching on the right of states to make laws that are reasonable and respectful and helpful for the well-being of women.
Now that we have this ruling from the Supreme Court, what's next for groups like yours, for Wisconsin Family Action, when it comes to abortion?
Well, that's a good question, because while we suffered this defeat with the high court, it certainly does not deter us from doing everything we can to protect unborn children as well as the women who are carrying those children. And so, you know, as the new legislative session gears up in the beginning of next year, we'll take a close look at what we think needs to be done to ensure that, well, women who are thinking about abortion get the information they need to make an informed decision, and that should they decide to go ahead with that, that their well-being, their safety, their health is of primary importance.
Jelaine, thank you so much for being with us.
Thanks for the opportunity.
That was Jelaine Appling, president of Wisconsin Family Action. Now, Barbara Perry joins us here on Central Time for analysis of the three U.S. Supreme Court decisions announced yesterday, one overturning the Texas abortion law, another that upholds restriction on gun ownership for those convicted of misdemeanor counts of domestic violence, and a third that overturned the conviction of Virginia's former governor, Bob McDonnell. Barbara Perry is a professor of ethics and institutions and director of presidential studies at the University of Virginia's Miller Center. Barbara, welcome back to Central Time.
Great to be with you, Veronica.
Well, let's start with the latest on that Supreme Court ruling on the Texas abortion law. Now, the court has already rejected appeals from Wisconsin and Mississippi over similar laws, like the one that was being enacted here in Wisconsin, as we said. What about similar laws where there hasn't been a court challenge yet? Do you see anything else coming down the pike?
Well, it's possible that those who would be against such laws would say, well, sure, let's go ahead and just play this out. Let's take a challenge to such laws, and we'll work our way through the federal system. And as we do so, from the very first, even at a U.S. district court, the thing about a Supreme Court decision that's decided by a majority, and this case, of course, was 5-3, once that happens, then the U.S. Supreme Court has set the precedent for all of the lower federal courts. So it is now the case that the lower federal court judges would have to apply the law as written and announced yesterday by the Supreme Court. So that's why your previous guest, of course, was concerned and understandably disappointed by the court's ruling, because it means that that strategy of those who oppose access to abortion, of trying to work through the clinic side of it and the provision side of it, the doctor side of it, we'll have to determine a different strategy, a different political and legal strategy.
One provision of the Wisconsin law was to require an ultrasound before an abortion could be obtained. Do you see provisions like that particular one coming any sort of legal challenge?
Mm-hmm. That, so that that's an interesting one. That's more like the case that, that people know as the Casey case, the Planned Parenthood versus Casey, than the governor of Pennsylvania. That came down 25 years ago with Justice O'Connor writing a joint opinion for herself and several others of the justices. And she developed what people might have heard yesterday as this case came down from the current court, the so-called undue burden test. And that was to look at both the kinds of limitations that, or requirements that would be placed on clinics, but also on women seeking abortions. And it was a little bit different from the old Roe versus Wade trimester approach that the court had used. In this instance, in 25 years ago, Justice O'Connor created this undue burden test. And it measures, in looking at every kind of either restriction or regulation placed on a clinic or placed on a woman seeking an abortion, whether that state limitation or state restriction causes what she said would be an undue burden to a woman seeking an abortion. And I always would point that out in the classroom to students, the term a woman. You know, if even one woman is burdened by these laws, then using that test, the court would say that the law was unconstitutional. And so that's where the kind of ultrasound requirement, or there were issues over the years of a 24-hour waiting period for a woman, or a requirement in Pennsylvania that she would have to consult with and get the consent of her partner. And that's how the court, through Justice O'Connor's undue burden test, would measure whether that could be a constitutional or an unconstitutional limitation on a woman's right to seek an abortion.
Do you have a better sense of the parameters of the undue burden test now that we have some ideas what it applies to so far, like admitting privileges?
Yes, because what the court was saying, I think, in yesterday's decision, by virtue of that Texas law, which had then required, I shouldn't say required, but resulted in the closure of, as I understand it, about half of the state's abortion provider clinics, would indicate to the court that now an undue burden was going to be placed on a woman trying to seek an abortion in Texas, such a large state geographically and with fewer options to go to. I think it went from 40-some-odd clinics down to about 19. That very concept could be viewed as posing an undue burden for a woman seeking an abortion in Texas.
Now, looking now at about how all this could affect the presidential race taking place right now, leading up to the fall, candidate Donald Trump has announced that he is pro-life. Hillary Clinton says she is pro-choice. How do you expect this particular debate and decision to affect the race?
Well, it will be fascinating, won't it, that you have two diametrically opposed positions that each of these presumptive candidates has staked out. And oftentimes voters will say, or I would certainly hear students say in the classroom, oh, there's not a dime's worth of difference between the two candidates. I just think they're all politicians are alike, and then there's some negative stereotype of a politician. And in this instance, people can't say that about Mrs. Clinton or Mr. Trump. They have staked out very different positions. Mrs. Clinton has certainly been a pro-choice, pro-abortion advocate for many, many years as a feminist. And Donald Trump, I would be hard-pressed to say, you know, over the scope of his life or his public life, because he hasn't been a politician for very long, it's hard to say, but famously in an interview with Chris Matthews, he allowed that he thought women seeking an abortion should face civil or criminal punishment for it, which was quite a statement to make.
We're talking to Barbara Perry right now from the University of Virginia's Miller Center, talking about three U.S. Supreme Court rulings released yesterday.
You can join the conversation at 800-642-1234. How do you think these Supreme Court rulings will play in the presidential race this fall and the empty seat on the Supreme Court? The ability to appoint that next Supreme Court justice, is that something that will affect the vote? Will it affect your vote in November? And a lot of people vote because of their feelings on abortion. This ruling out, do you think this is something that will sway the way you vote? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also post on the Central Time Facebook page.
We'll continue the conversation and get to your calls in just a bit here on Central Time.
This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. And we're picking up our discussion now with Barbara Perry from the University of Virginia about the U.S. Supreme Court rulings released yesterday.
You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have an opinion on those rulings released yesterday? And is this something you're watching closely? The U.S. Supreme Court, the empty seat on that U.S. Supreme Court, possible openings coming up as we head toward the presidential race. Is this something motivating you to vote for a candidate? Maybe to vote for a candidate that otherwise you're not that excited about. Call 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
Barbara, if you look back a decade or two, there was a lot of attention paid to the single-issue voter, and a lot of the times that single-issue voter was one who voted based on a candidate's position on abortion. Now, do you see that this ruling, this decision from the U.S. Supreme Court, could reignite, I mean, it hasn't ever really gone away, but could reignite that same sort of phenomenon now to a greater extent?
Of course, there are still many one-issue voters. Hard to know exactly how many, but there certainly are some, and it depends on the issue. So for some people, it's guns, and for some people, it's religious issues, and this may be a religious issue for many people. So for some, it'll be a women's rights issue. I have a colleague here at the University of Virginia who, very renowned constitutional scholar, and for him, it was affirmative action because he had grown up a Jewish German lad in Hitler's Germany and had to run for his life from the Nazis because of his religion. So he never wanted religion or race or gender or ethnicity to be used in any kind of employment or academic decision-making process. So it depends on people's backgrounds, and it could be that they are one-issue voters. And abortion, because it's so obviously viewed by many as a matter of life and death, it is something that creates a great deal of emotion. And I suspect that this ruling yesterday will not only continue for those who believe that's the one issue that they want to pick their candidate on, will also have an impact on how people are viewing that open seat of Justice, the late Justice Scalia on the bench.
Well, I want to talk more about that, but first let's get to some of the other rulings. One of them yesterday upheld restrictions preventing those convicted of misdemeanor counts of domestic violence from owning a gun. Tell us more about that decision in that case.
Right. So the question was whether someone who had been convicted under a state law of a misdemeanor and a domestic abuse, on specifically whether that assault conviction for what they called reckless conduct could trigger this prohibition in the federal law of not being allowed to purchase or own a firearm. And the court decided yes, and took sort of the gun control position on it in a 6-2 decision, that indeed these state laws, state convictions, could be used in the federal, under the federal statute, to prohibit those who had been accused and convicted of domestic violence from obtaining a firearm.
And the word reckless played a role here. Tell us about that word.
Well, it did. And this was part of the issue that the person who had had this misdemeanor conviction on his record and was being denied access to a gun had said that there was a difference, and in fact the law recognized a difference between a reckless push, let's say, or as Justice Thomas in dissent said, you know, what if somebody just swings a baseball bat and they don't really mean to hit anybody, but they accidentally do? Well, you could say they didn't intend to hit anybody, but they recklessly swung the bat, and so they hit their domestic partner. He was trying to draw a distinction between those two acts and the intention behind them. A reckless instance, not intentional. Intentional, obviously intentional. And the court in the majority did not go along with that in a 6-2 case, 6-2 decision with Justice Kagan writing for the liberals on the bench. Although, interestingly enough, she was also joined by more conservative Justices Alito and Chief Justice Roberts. And Justice Sotomayor, usually pretty reliably in the liberal camp and you would think of as a feminist, she joined in dissent with Justice Thomas on this ground of trying to determine the difference between reckless and intentional acts of violence against a domestic partner. The dissenters saw a difference between them. The majority did not.
And it sounds like this case, early on especially, got a little extra attention because of Justice Clarence Thomas. Tell us what happened.
Yes. Well, it's hard in some ways to believe, especially someone like myself who follows the court closely over the years and been to many, many oral arguments, but he's well known for not speaking during oral arguments. And in fact, he had gone an entire decade without asking a question. And finally, after a decade, he asked a question in this case. And it was asking about this issue of the Second Amendment, a constitutional right to own and bear arms, and how that would relate to somebody being given a lifetime ban of having access to a firearm. And he thought that this was, and stated so, thought this was the only instance of a constitutional right that was being denied to someone on a lifetime basis because of, in this case, a simply reckless act of domestic violence.
We're talking to the University of Virginia's Miller Center, Barbara Perry, right now, talking about recent U.S. Supreme Court decisions. And the third we want to get to today is a ruling that some say could make it more difficult to prosecute public officials for corruption. This relates to the case of Virginia Governor Bob McDonnell. Barbara, set that up for us. What was the case centered around?
Well, as you can imagine, those of us here in the Old Dominion were watching this one carefully. Our former governor, after he had left office, and along with his wife, were tried for public corruption because they had accepted up to $175,000 worth of loans, money, gifts, Rolex watches, trips, vacations, partial payment of their daughter's wedding reception from a man who was peddling an elixir, I will call it, a tobacco-based elixir, a health supplement that, I should put it more neutrally, a health supplement that he wanted the governor to help him peddle by giving him introductions to people in state government. He actually wanted Virginia State Universities to do health studies about this. Now, he never got that far, but Governor McDonnell had set up meetings for him with state officials, had had meetings and lunches at which this man was able to present his view about this elixir to people or this health supplement at lunches at the Capitol. And so the prosecution, this was a federal statute that was said to be violated as a bribery situation, so that this man with his health supplement giving all this money to the governor and his wife had then curried favor with the governor and his wife. That was the application of the federal law that was viewed as official acts that had been done in return for this money and these many opportunities that had been given the governor.
And what did the Supreme Court say?
And the Supreme Court said that the lower federal courts had given too broad a definition to public or official acts. The Chief Justice, in writing this, we should note, for a unanimous court, 8-0, really tightened the definition of a public act to say that in order to see a corruption, you'd have to see the money or the gifts coming in to a public official and then a specific public act, an official act of signing a law, for example, or creating, in this instance, the governor, if he had created or ordered the state university to do tests on this elixir. And absent that, the court was saying that what the governor did not fall under the official acts component of this federal bribery statute. And so, in effect, then, his conviction was overturned and sent back then to the Fourth Circuit Court of Appeals here in Virginia to decide whether under this narrower definition of official act that there should be a new trial of the former governor.
And we leave it there. Barbara, thank you so much for joining us today.
Oh, you're so welcome, Veronica. Thank you.
That was Barbara Perry, Professor of Ethics and Institutions and Director of Presidential Studies at the University of Virginia's Miller Center. And she joined us there to break down those three recent U.S. Supreme Court rulings that were just announced yesterday. I'm Veronica Ricker.
And I'm Rob Farah. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network.